Today's episode of Darkness Radio is brought to you by Surfshark. Surfshark is a cybersecurity product that improves your online privacy and protects you from hackers. Try Surfshark today totally risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/darkness. Enter promo code DARKNESS for 3 extra months for free. You heard me right, 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/darkness. Welcome in to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Got a real treat for you today, folks. Here's what we're doing. I got the opportunity and the pleasure to watch a brand new movie that is out there. It is a documentary called Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness and the Borrego Triangle. And when we say high strangeness, we mean high strangeness. Now, there's very little virgin territory that's left out there as far as investigation goes. And we've combed the earth, so to speak, as investigators looking for new stuff to investigate. There's two investigators out there who've put together this particular documentary, which, by the way, is very intriguing, very good. You want to check it out. It's available right now on Apple TV Plus and on Amazon Prime. I myself got a sneak peek. And I went and rented it again on Apple TV Plus just to, you know, kind of put my own little money in the kitty. Derek Hayes and David Flora are the two main investigators that are on this documentary. And let's bring them in now. Derek Hayes is the creator and host of award-winning podcast Monsters Among Us, an anthology of real paranormal stories told by the witnesses themselves. Hayes has also appeared as an on-camera expert on the Travel Channel series Paranormal Caught on Camera, seasons 1-4. He currently calls the mountains above Los Angeles his home, but originates from the backwoods of Southeast Ohio. Hayes has also appeared on the Travel Channel series In Search of Monsters and has spoken on panels at AlienCon, LA Comic Con, and Crypticon. David Flora is also with us. He is a Kentucky-born, Colorado-based actor, writer, and podcaster, an 11-year podcast veteran. He hosts the award-winning paranormal podcast Blurry Photos. He also hosts a trivia podcast, Quiz Quiz Bang Bang, and another paranormal podcast, Hysteria 51. I think he's got 18 jobs. He also has a short story pod, 5-Minute Frights. You can also hear more of his narration on Audible or Amazon, where he has numerous audiobooks as well. Let's welcome in to Darkness Radio, Derek Hayes and David Flora. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks, Tim, for having us. We appreciate it.
Hey, Tim, how you doing?
Good. Now, guys, okay, I have one complaint about the movie before we start, and then we can get it out of the way, and we can start clean. Are you ready? What's with the radio voices at the beginning of the movie? Okay.
Which ones?
No, I kid. No, the low and slow and the blah, blah, blah. And I know that's not your voices. Come on. You guys have wonderful, beautiful voices. We've been sitting here talking before the show. And they're so wonderful, natural. No, there's the uncomfortable silence. I'm busting balls here.
You got to put that spooky factor into it a little bit.
Okay.
So, you know.
Yeah, that was an homage to Derek's show.
And, you know, truth be told, I tried to tone it down a little bit and everybody's like, nah, you got to go do the voice. I ended up right back into the voice.
Come on. You didn't. It wasn't needed. It wasn't needed. I cringed as a 30-year broadcaster. I cringed.
Oh, no, that's not good.
No. Yeah. You don't have to do it. You have to tell every filmmaker when they tell you to do that, just go, come on. Come on. It's overdone. Well, it's like the best way to put it to a filmmaker is, okay, so then when we do your documentary. We're going to have you do that large pan on a crane and be like, yeah, and give the thumbs up when they hit that shot. You know, it's one of those cliche, you know, cliche deals.
They wouldn't give us a crane. We tried.
Yeah, tried for that. I'm sorry. All right. So Shadows in the Desert. By the way, wonderful film, guys. Enjoyed the film.
Thank you.
Loved it. Let's talk about the Borrego Triangle and why the Borrego Triangle. And tell us a little bit about the Borrego Triangle. Let's start with David. David, what is the fascination with this area of California?
The fascination is that it's not talked about a lot, and hasn't been talked about in a condensed fashion over the years. And we started looking into it, starting with a creature called the Borrego Sandman. And from there, all these stories started coming out. You've got ghost tales of the Wild West. You've got UFO sightings that go even until today. Cryptid sightings, Bigfoot sightings that go to very recently. And it's a very concentrated area of high strangeness. And we wanted to bring attention to it to get all these stories out there in the world. So that's where the fascination with it lies for us.
Derek, I want to jump into one of the first things in the film. And we generally, in areas where we're investigating, come up with women or ladies in white. That's one of the first areas of that comes up in the movie. And let's talk ghost stories first, right off the bat, which is one of the huge things that my audience loves to hear about, especially when it comes to the paranormal, supernatural. What is it with women in white? And I know you kind of cover it a little bit in the film, but what is it with this particular phenomena of ghost?
I think for me, in my personal opinion, is that it's such a recognizable image. I mean, you think of the classic image of a ghost and you're going to rattle off a handful of things like rattling chains, a pale color, you know, see-through, translucent, and a lot of times like a woman in a white gown. That's what people often report. And, you know, these things are reported throughout the country, throughout the world, even Lady Bend Hill, back where I'm from in Ohio, Resurrection Mary, where David spent a lot of time. You know, these things are just everywhere. The unique thing about Our Lady in White here is that she's actually buried where she's seen. So there is an actual real connection to it that we can verify. She's right there in the ground. And this woman was traveling across that area on a stagecoach and fell ill and ended up passing away. And, you know, she's been there ever since. So to me, it's just that imagery. You know, you see something like that or somebody tells you about something like that and you can quickly imagine it. And that just makes it a lot more real.
And psychologically, I think that there is something extra tragic about someone who is in this attire. Usually it's like a wedding gown, a prom dress, something that they have dressed up for a formal occasion for. And when they're killed in this state, it's going from one of the highest of highs to nothing, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can't even feel. So it's there's something I think that your mind latches onto with that drop in a sudden disappointment, that tragedy that is over the top at that point, you know. And that's something that I think you can layer on to these stories and just look into and why maybe they resonate so well with everyone who hears them.
It's stated in the movie, and I think you guys put it eloquently, that it doesn't seem like there's a lot of ghost men wandering the planet saying, you know, I miss my bride. I've been killed before my time. It's too bad I couldn't get married. Why is it seems like that the men out there aren't longing for the bride they never had?
That was a really good point. Sapphire Sandala was one of our guests on the documentary there, and she actually brought that point to us. That wasn't even our idea. That was 100% hers. And it's a really good question. I mean, I don't know the answer, frankly, but it is, you know, she poses a really good question. Why are these gender roles treated differently? It's really interesting.
David, do you think, is it because, I hate to put it this way. I mean, let's get into it a little bit. Is it because men have a hard time finding the true love of their life in this life? And maybe women have an easier time finding the love of their life?
I think for men, when you hear ghost stories that involve a male figure doing the haunting, it's often violent. It's something where they have either perpetrated or been a victim of violence, as opposed to either dying of heartbreak or coming to a tragic end suddenly. I don't know if dudes just aren't concerned with the prom in the afterlife or, you know, weddings or whatever, but it seems to me that there's a pretty stark contrast between male violence in ghost stories and female tragedy. And again, like Sapphire said in the film, there's something to be said about the culture and what is important to each, you know, gender at the time or whatever. And so, yeah, it is I think that's a question, a sociological question you could probably dive into and write a book on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. It seems like that you're right, David, that it's a violent thing when it comes to men. What it seems like when a man loses his life violently, he reaches back to want to grasp onto life. And that seems like the basis for most ghost stories that he wants to either, I don't want to say hold on to that life, but he wants some, it's either a residual haunting where the energy stays there, or it's, I need to tell somebody of how I went. I need to remind somebody that I was.
Yeah, some sort of control of the situation.
Yes,
exactly. There's also, you could probably boil it down to revenge or justice, you know, something,
right.
Something in those realms as well.
Right. Whereas I think, and I don't want to get stereotypical here because it's not a stereotypical thing. I think with women, it's very much, it has more to do with your heart and it has to do with more complex issues. I don't think men are as complex as women. I think that's just what it comes down to. You know, I think maybe we're a little more hardwired to the here and now and women are more esoteric. Is that a good way of putting it? Maybe.
Could be.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that
area. It's really hard to,
it's a really great subject to write a book on, actually, you know, the more we talk about it, because you also have the example of something like La Llorona,
yes,
who that was all about revenge. And, you know, she was doing this to these children of her husband who had cheated on her or whatever, you know, however, whichever flavor of the story you go with, there is a very violent thing with that the woman perpetrates there. And so, you know, it I don't know how many examples of each you have,
yeah,
to really make a judgment call on, but it's very interesting when you start looking at the psychology of ghost stories.
Yeah, it truly is. And you have a few in this movie which are fascinating. David, I want you to tackle the one about the miners. You have a particular one having to do with, is that at the well? And I forget the name of the well. Was it three miners that were in the
There fight? Were three. Well, they were brothers or immigrants or a combination that came to Yucky Well. Mm-hmm. Which was along the Butterfield stage line at the time. And it was just a watering hole. And these guys were wandering in the desert up from, you know, probably Mexico, heading up to San Francisco or Sacramento, somewhere up north to, you know, probably hunt for gold. And they found this watering hole and they hadn't had water in days. And, you know, they start drinking. One of them immediately dies because the dilution of the water in the blood cells can cause them to swell and can be lethal. And the other guys found gold in the guy's pocket and fought over it. And then one of them ended up killing the other, and then he ran off into the desert, and like it was just this scene of sudden and violent death in this one spot on this trail in the triangle. And people, you know, have told stories about seeing ghostly figures reenacting this fight, this death that happened there. And we got to go out and investigate. It's not a hard place to get to. Out of all of the spots in the triangle, this one was one of the easiest to get to. And it's still there. They have it marked, and you can go and check it out. And it was an interesting investigation when we went out there, and we showed a little bit of that in the film.
I want to bring that up real quick. I like the fact that you guys are, especially out in this area of the country, that you guys are out there. One of the things you state in the beginning of the film is how dangerous this area of the country really is. Derek, if you would, talk to us real quick about exactly how dangerous this area is.
Well, a lot of people die there, you know, every year. People go out for a 1 mile hike and never come back. So that was a big concern of ours. You know, we had a crew of anywhere from 7 to 10 people at any given time. And there was a huge concern, you know, no rattlesnakes, no scorpions, no mountain lions, no heat exhaustion, no heat stroke, nothing like that. There's all sorts of dangers out there. And, you know, if any of those things don't get you, the place is the size of Rhode Island. So you could take a wrong turn, go down a dirt road, get stuck, and you wouldn't see another person for a week. So if you don't have...
Just like in Rhode Island.
Just like,
wow.
So it was certainly dangerous to be out there. Now, that said, it is a state park, so there are rangers and stuff like that out there. So it's not the Wild West anymore. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 122 degrees, there's not a lot of rangers out there checking back roads. So you kind of got to take your life into your own hands when you go out there, especially that time of year. And we were very careful about it. We had to be, but it was certainly something we were very worried about. I was much more afraid of heat stroke than I was any ghosts or Sasquatch. I can tell you that much.
So what kind of precautions do you and your crew take when you go out there with 122 degree heat? Keep in mind, I'm in Minnesota. When we get to 70, I'm sweating like you wouldn't believe. There's clothing going everywhere. 122 degrees, no thank you. But what kind of precautions do you take when you know you're going into an extreme environment like that?
Well, I was like a mom at a soccer game. I was yelling at everybody, here, drink this Gatorade, drink this water, just shoving waters in people's faces. You know, we took everything with us. We had a lot of food, a lot of water we brought with us, even though we weren't planning on going too far. And the other big thing was just pick your time of day. You know, if it's 7 in the morning, it might only be 95. And, you know, that's brisk and beautiful compared to 122 at noon. So you pick your time of your day when it's best to go out. Now, of course, we couldn't do that all the time with our filming schedule. So there's a scene where we go out and look at some rock art, Native American rock art out there. And it is every bit of 122, 123 degrees out there. And I think we walked a total of 3.5-4 miles to get to this spot out, just out in the sun. And that was spooky, to use the word correctly right there. I was very worried about that trip.
Okay.
The other thing, we encouraged proper attire.
Yes.
You need a hat, you need sunglasses, cover up. You know, that's, it seems a little opposite of what you might think, but if you're wearing long sleeves and all kinds of stuff, it helps keep the sun off your skin. Our sound guy dressed up like a literal ninja, like he had one of those ski masks, and the only thing you could see was like his sunglasses, and everything else was covered head to toe. He's wearing gloves and everything. And
wow.
He took it real seriously.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say, David, you and I share the same hairstyle. We both have shaved heads, and I know that in itself is just danger when you go out there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I know you had to be a little concerned as well. And I noticed that in the movie, during the entire day, you're covered up. At night is the only time where your head covering comes off.
Yeah, a little looser.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, I mean, that's important as well. The elements in themselves, and I know the temperature falls really quickly too when you get towards night. And there are some night shots in here too, especially when you start talking about, there's a train derailment portion of the movie and in a issue having to do with you guys are playing with quartz at one time, which is just one of the coolest parts of the movie, having to do with you're talking about ghost lights, and we'll get to that here in a bit. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. But the one thing I love about this movie, and again, as investigators, you're not just going into the stories and then trying to find the phenomena. You're going into the stories and you're also looking at the science behind it. You bring in different scientists as well, trying to explain the phenomena. And in order to do that, you have to go into the field. You're not only just talking to scientists and then saying, okay, that's enough. You'll see that in a lot of different documentaries, but you're going out and you're trying things in the field as well. But then to have to put up with the elements as you're doing it, to me, I cringed a little. Knowing that you're putting up with the heat, you're putting up with everything, and then you're standing in it, and then you've got the, you know, you've got the danger on top of it. Kudos to both of you. I just have to put that note in there as we continue. I want to talk a little bit about the scientific part of it, because, you know, it's more than just bringing a tri-field meter or a K2 meter or whatever type of thing you're bringing out into the field. You're outside, which makes it a little bit more difficult. And I'm wondering, let's start with you, David. Talk about a little bit of the challenges of trying to get some of those readings and some of that scientific evidence when you're outdoors. Is it a little bit different? How so? What are the challenges?
Yeah, well, we haven't done a ton of on-site investigations between us. We're book nerds, I think, more than anything. But it was important for us to get out there and experience things and try things and show that, you know, we're trying to take it as seriously as we can with what we have access to. And so Derek brought a lot of equipment out there. We have an EMF meter that I used at Yucky Well. Derek had a FLIR camera, a parabolic mic, and stuff like that. So there were challenges specifically with those last two that I mentioned. The FLIR camera was basically useless because everything was hot. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if something wanted to hide out there from infrared, go for it. It's done. You can't see it. It's invisible at that point.
Same temperature as the background, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. And then the parabolic mic was tough because there's a ton of wildlife out there, and you get a lot of insects. You get a lot of the brush rattling with the wind and stuff. Coyotes are everywhere. So it's tough to, I think we would need a lot more experience to be able to really suss out anything that's different from background noise, in our future endeavors. I think we would need to do a little bit more of that stuff just to figure out if we're doing it correctly or not, or if there's anything actually to use. But it was very interesting. Like, we did get a growl at one point or something weird on the mic. We took pictures. Derek had a digital camera with a flash. We showed how there's dust in the air, and you can't really take anything from that of value that we thought. Derek, what else did we throw out there?
Oh man, you did some whoops. You did some wood knocks.
Yes, please. Let's bring up the whoops.
David spent weeks practicing these whoops.
The most science, yeah. I imitated it perfectly.
No, in reality, we didn't have a ton of time to do the researching. You know, we had a strict schedule. We shot for, I always forget the number, I think it's 13 days or something like that. So we only had a finite amount of time to go out into the field and search for these things. So I feel like for us to really take it seriously, we'd have to be out there for a couple of days in order to observe all this stuff, observe it enough to realize something's unusual, because everything's unusual while we're out there. Like, every sound we hear is like, oh, you know, what the hell was that? Mm-hmm. So for me, time would really go a long way as far as the field research is concerned out there. But, you know, that's how filmmaking is. You know, you get a certain amount of time and you take advantage of what you got.
Would it be safe to say, Derek, that once you got out there, you suddenly realized what other researchers are up against when they go looking for something like, say, the Sandman or different things, and how much of a needle in a haystack it is to look for something like Bigfoot or UFOs, or when you start trying to separate natural wildlife from the paranormal or the strange, that you really are sifting through a lot in order to get to that minute.
Yeah.
You really have to know what you're doing. For sure.
And I think we both kind of went into it extremely skeptical. I think we were both doubting a lot of the stories we heard. And once we got out there and saw how big and vast and how diverse the terrain is, suddenly we kind of looked at each other like, there might be something to some of this. You know, anything could be hiding out here. It's so huge and empty.
I think the layman thinks desert and they associate it with desolate. So they go, okay, yeah. Well, piece of cake. You're going to walk out in the desert. There's not a thing there. And it's just going to land in your lap. So yeah. I think most people who go into this movie are going to think, well, it's a slam dunk. You guys are going to walk out there and, you know, things are going to land in your lap. And we're just going to film this, go home, and we're going to make a great movie.
That's what we were hoping for.
But you guys did a phenomenal job of first research. Second, going out in the field and finding the things that you're looking for. And third, getting over the elements to get the things you needed on film. It's a wonderful combination of putting all of it together in a hostile terrain, which I don't think people can really get a proper, I guess, appreciation for unless they live in the area. Again, this is in California. In the California desert. But when you really take a good look at it and put it in its proper scope, you go, man. And some of the overhead shots are just beautiful. There's just some beautiful shots of the desert and the terrain. And when you start to look at the harsh environment on the film, you go, wow, how did you guys ever find anything?
Every shot you see is days and days worth of planning, scheduling, you know, getting all the equipment together, then walking out to these places out in this weather. So there was a lot of work that went into literally every frame that went into the film, but especially those remote shots where we're out exploring a cave or looking at rock art or, you know, chasing down a lady in white or something like that.
One of the fun things also with shoots like this is you could just be driving along the highway trying to get to the next place, and you look over and you see, like, this looks awesome. Look at this place. Let's pull over and just get something, you know, even if it's B-roll, even if it's something that we can throw in, you know, while we were doing narration or something. There's this amazing section where everything had been burnt by a wildfire.
Okay.
And it looks like so gnarly and like otherworldly. We were like, let's get out and just traipse through this thing. We'll talk about some stuff, you know, with Sasquatch and things over on that ridge. But the area, like, there's so many different types of area that you can find out there. Not only just the washes and the desolate desert, like you were saying, but it goes up in elevation a few thousand feet at least, and you have a completely different region. It's scrubs and trees, pines, and then like I said, this burnt out wildfire area. Like, it's there's so many different interesting locales in the park. It was really, it helped us a lot.
Wow. Yeah. I'm telling you, it's beautifully shot. There's just so many locations that you guys so accurately portray how dangerous this place is. Like I said, I don't know how you found a thing out there, but you managed to put together such a captivating movie. Guys, the name of the movie, Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness in the Borrego Triangle. Tell you what, we're going to take our break right here. When we come back, want to talk a little bit, I'm kind of holding back a little bit on this. We're going to talk a little bit about the Sandman of the Borrego Triangle. When we come back, we're also going to talk a little bit about the potential existence of, we call it high strangeness. We'll talk about the lights that are out there. What are these lights? Are they a phenomena of the terrain that's out there? Are these UFO? Are they something else? We'll talk about it with our guests. Our guests today are Derek Hayes and David Flora, and they're the co-creators of this wonderful movie that you've got to check out. By the way, it's available on Apple TV Plus, and on Amazon Prime. We've got links to it in the description of this program. It's called Shadows in the Desert. When we come back, strange lights. Are they UFO or something just possibly more? Could it just be an effect of the natural terrain in the Borrego Triangle? We'll talk about that. Plus, the Sandman of the Borrego Triangle and much, much more. Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness in the Borrego Triangle with our guests, Derek Hayes and David Flora, right here on Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. We're talking about the movie Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness in the Borrego Triangle. Our guests are Derek Hayes and David Flora, the co-creators of this movie. And of course, boy, I'll tell you, two warriors and investigators who put this thing together, because I'll tell you, folks, once you get a hold of this beautiful movie, you'll find out that this thing wasn't easy. Wasn't easy to put together, but it was put together beautifully. The research, wonderful on this thing. And, of course, the investigation on it, amazing as well. Guys, one of the things that fascinated me about the movie, you're talking about strange lights that appear, much like the Brown Mountain lights out in this area of the country. Let's talk about these first. And the natural phenomena that happen with these in this area. Talk to me, first of all, let's go to Derek. Let's talk a little bit about these lights. Describe to me and our audience what it is exactly I'm talking about, because I'm fumbling around trying to describe them. You tell our audience what exactly I'm talking about.
Well, you know, these lights are one of the first things that drew me to the Anza Borrego area in the first place, because I've heard reports of them for a long time. Now, you know, a lot of places, like you mentioned, Brown Mountain or Marfa or Paulding, a lot of these places have these ghost lights, but they're a little bit different here in the Triangle because they're not in one specific location. They could show up anywhere. And they seem to travel, too. They're not, you know, stationary. They zip across the desert floor. They shoot across the road in front of your car, something like that. They seem to be mobile, I guess, active. So first of all, we have that difference there. And then the crazy thing about the ghost orbs down, or ghost lights or whatever you want to call these things down there in the Borrego Triangle, is that they may or may not have actually killed somebody. There was a train accident that we found that was blamed on some of these lights. And of course, in the film, we go and research all that. So there's some historical context to these lights as well. And, you know, I don't know if I mentioned, but they'd been seen for hundreds of years. This isn't, you know, something recent. This is centuries old. Mm-hmm. And then to tie it all together with a nice little bow, there's all sorts of petroglyphs and rock art out there that seems to depict lights, different color lights, blue lights, red lights. There's a cave out there called the Blue Cave Sun. Is that right? No, Blue Sun. Blue Sun Cave. And it just has all these lights drawn on there. That's how I interpret it. Of course, we don't know for sure what it is, but it all just seems to come back to these ghost lights.
Now, David, there's a scene in this movie, and it's surmised by a geologist you have on the program on the movie, that this light activity could be happening by quartz dust or quartz being slammed together. That this quartz that's slammed together, quartz which is found in our phones, it's found in different instruments that we use from day to day, that this quartz being slammed together creates sparks. So you guys have a mind to get a hold of some quartz. And of course, metaphysical people use quartz all the time. They give quartz as gifts. You guys decide to get a hold of some quartz. You're going to do an experiment. What do you guys do?
Yeah, this is something I wanted to make sure made it into the film, just because I feel like quartz is getting more and more attention these days in the paranormal world. On its supposed effects in places of high strangeness and paranormal topics. So I think there's a lot, you know, to still research and go into with that. But since we were out there and quartz is abundant out there in the park, I wanted to get a a scientist. I want to get somebody who knew what they were doing to talk to about these effects that quartz has. And is there any, you know, possibility that some of these, for instance, ghost lights that we've just been talking about could have some kind of basis in a scientific explanation? So in the film, we go through a, you know, it's not, you know, you don't get to the theory level of it, but this hypothesis that quartz could stir up enough particles of it in a dust devil or something, strike together, maybe even enough to light that dry kind of foliage that gets thrown around, tumbleweeds and stuff like that. Could that light it on fire, have a little bitty fireball that's kind of floating up or moving along in this dust devil and then flames out, you know, and is that something that people could see? So we actually do an experiment where we grab some quartz. It was basically quartzite out there. It's not pure quartz that we picked up, and took it home and bashed it together and to see, you know, can this even produce a spark? That's number one. And so we tried this little home experiment with it. I talked to the geologist and really, you know, at the end of it, I think it comes down to Occam's razor with this. Is there enough of these different elements that could cause something like that to happen scientifically? Is it more likely that all these things line up, or is it more likely that someone, you know, it's something else, let's say. I don't even want to say like it's someone just thinking they see something or mistaking something, or it's a ghost or a UFO or something like that. Like, putting that aside, I just wanted to follow this scientific train of thought. And for me, it kind of came down to there's a lot of elements that go into what would make a fireball come up in the middle of the desert. It's a little bit beyond the pale for me. It's a bridge too far for all this stuff to line up perfectly. You know what I mean? So,
right,
but
right.
I thought it was important to follow this scientific thought with this, get someone who knew what they were talking about to come in and weigh in on it and things like that. That was something that we thought was important to share with people on this journey.
And you guys were dead on with that experiment. I found it fascinating because you're right. The geologist came in, talked about how quartz and quartz dust could, as you said, you put it eloquently, could kick up with a tumbleweed, could start something on fire. I found it kind of a stretch. Let's put it this way. It was a lot of a stretch. And that it could create this fireball and someone could mistake it. And I went, come on. When you're talking, you know, when you're talking about something like one of your guests had pointed out, like a Foo Fighter or something like that, where it's traveling, like a traveling light. And I'm sure Derek will back this up too. As it's traveling a certain amount of distance, a fireball flames out quite quickly. Right, David? So
yeah.
why would a quartz fireball travel for a certain amount of distance, and what fuels it to maintain it a certain amount of distance? I don't buy that. There's not enough tumbleweeds out there in the desert to keep a fireball going for that long. But again, Derek, you get my kudos for getting the biggest spark out of that quartz, I think, out of the two of you. I found the experiment cool because you guys got the quartz together, and then like a couple of Boy Scouts out there trying to light a fire, you had the quartz banging together quite well, and you had it going. You guys got to see the scene in the movie because it's really funny and it's really good. I got a kick out of it. The two of you out there banging rocks together to try and create this supposed spark that the geologist says you can get out of quartz. I want to make that segue from quartz to a different rock as we get into our next subject, and that is sandstone. You guys point out that there's also sandstone there in the Borrego area in the desert. I bring up sandstone because sandstone is a common rock and mineral that we have here in the Twin Cities area in Minnesota. In fact, we've made Target Field in the left field wall out of sandstone. It's very easy. I believe in the film they call it the your expert calls it the styrofoam of rock out there because it's easy to bore into. Yeah. Reason I bring it up is let's bring up the Sandman of Borrego there. Or Sasquatch as we know them, Sasquatch or Bigfoot. Derek, tell us a little bit about the Sandman and the origin of the Sandman and what we're talking about here.
Well, to trace down the origin of Sasquatch, that's a long track. But the Southern California Sasquatch, we'll narrow it down a bit. There have been reports all over SoCal, believe it or not. It's a fairly deserty area down here, but there have been reports all over, and especially down near San Diego, just east of San Diego, which ironically is where the Triangle is today. So these legends have existed, and over the years they seem to be concentrated down further and further to now they seem to be in a few small areas where they're still seen and reported. And Joshua Tree National Park is one of them that's just north of our Triangle, and of course the Borrego Triangle itself. And, the reports of this creature are a little bit different than what you get throughout the rest of the country. It's often described as smaller, not as tall, but certainly skinnier, scrawnier. Like it doesn't, obviously doesn't eat enough. The hair color is said to be like a blonde, a strawberry blonde color, almost white. Maybe camouflage reasons, something that if you're out in the heat, you don't want dark fur.
Sure.
It's said to have longer fur on it, which also makes sense. Blowing sand, that sort of thing. You want that sort of protection. And, we started digging into this once we got out there, and we actually met up with a couple people that had seen something recently, recent as in the last like 10, 15 years. And as this information started coming out, I think David and I's mind started to change just a bit about the possibilities here. And then we sort of stumbled upon a little bit of information that really made it seem possible. As David said earlier, the park's kind of divvied up into two sections. You have the low desert, and then you have the higher altitude mountains with, pine forests, 8,000, 9,000 feet. They have snow, they have water. It's really nice up there. So what we discovered is in the summertime, all of these reports would flood out of the higher elevations, where the trees and all that are. And then in the wintertime, when it's cold, all the reports seem to come out of the lower desert area. So we're suspicious that if this creature does exist, that it might migrate from these two places and just make a circle every year, which A, would make it harder to find, B, makes it easier for it to exist, and C, is just pretty damn cool, honestly. I mean, if you're going to evade people, that's a brilliant way to do it.
Yeah. The reason I bring up sandstone is because in the movie, it's surmised that the Sandman or this Sasquatch is using sandstone and carving out caves, or the caves are there, I should put it that way, but using these sandstone caves to live or basically using them as their home, which is a little bit different than its cousins throughout the U.S., say like Bigfoot here in Minnesota, which uses a golf course. I don't know that that's what we say here in Minnesota. It's using the damn golf course. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's interesting is, and again, you guys go actually out to the mud caves to take a look, and you go out to actually investigate this area. But here's my one question with this. I actually have more than one question, but my question with this is, first of all, as you pointed out, Derek, they have a little bit different look to them, of course, with camouflage. The one thing going through my mind as I'm watching the movie is, how do these things survive in such an inhospitable environment? I mean, you think about it. You guys are having a hell of a time out there. Mind you, we're all not built for it. But you think about what's out there to eat other than insects and small reptiles. There's not a lot out there as far as, I guess, things to eat. You might have the occasional carrion to eat or whatever, but how do you surmise this thing exists?
We thought the same thing, frankly, before we started all this research. And we brought in a biologist and we brought in a botanist, and both of them said there's plenty of food for them to survive if they were to exist. And then if you think about it, there are several different Native American cultures that have survived in this area for millennia. So if they can survive, certainly another intelligent upright hominoid, whatever, could survive as well. And if you know what you're doing, I feel like it'd be pretty comfortable. There's actually, we don't talk about this much, but there's a place called Ghost Mountain up there. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have ghosts on it. It actually had a family in the 50s that were living primitively. It was a husband and wife and three kids, I believe. And they'd spent like 10 years up there, and they basically just lived off the land. And they lived a pretty comfortable life, with the exception of the storm or something would come by and then just kind of reset everything for them. But if you knock, you know, your technology down just a little bit, the storm's not even going to wipe you out. So in my mind, once we got out there, there was just too much. Like you said, the caves, there were mud caves, there were sandstone caves. There were other caves rumored that we heard several people tell us about that went from the higher elevations to the lower. And it was suggested that they even traveled those elevation changes through these tunnels. So essentially, a lot of the park seems to be underground over there. And, you know, if those spaces are vacant and available under the ground, who knows what's under there and what's using those to survive and travel.
How would you describe the demeanor of this Sandman? What would you say it is like personality-wise? We hear different stories about Bigfoot and what Bigfoot can be like. It can be either a benevolent creature, quite friendly. If you put food out for it, it can either be very kind, or it can be very angry and want more and more, or it can be quite the angry creature and just go after you and start attacking you. What do you hear about this particular creature?
Not a lot of, yeah.
Nothing not fun of, like that. Well, you know, that's not true. That's not true, David. Think about Dead Man Hole.
Well, yeah, there's that. And then we did have one interviewer who, it sounded like, and one interviewee, he had an encounter that it sounded like one of them kind of rushed him or did something to intimidate him away
like
from the area.
Charge is what it sounded like. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say they're more akin to like a skunk ape type thing or a Honey Island swamp monster type, where they prefer, you know, to be in solitude as much as they can. And they'll make shows of intimidation, or it's very skittish or, you know, something like that. So that's kind of the impression we got, but we didn't get anything that was super detailed as to, oh, this thing, you know, looked at me and it had gratitude in its eyes and I gave it an apple and, oh, my, you know, like we didn't get anything like that.
We did uncover a legend from the 1880s about a watering hole there where people were showing up dead. Uh-huh. And nobody was taking anything from them. They had their watch on them. They had their money, everything like that. So the rumor was started that it was, you know, a monster, the monster of Dead Man Hole that was, you know, attacking these people. And, I won't get too far into that. I'll let the movie spoil all that. But there was a lot of violence involved in that story. I think a dozen people ended up murdered before they finally figured
enough
out
enough to name
on.
The hole.
yeah. It got a rep.
I don't know what that threshold is, but they reached.
Yeah. It got a rep. So, you know, there was that. I'll leave it with this. And I don't want to get too much into it because it is a fascinating part of the movie and a part I want people to watch. But again, with this Sandman, I don't want to put too much on the characteristic of it either. But do you surmise, David, that maybe it's got this personality that you're talking about because the area is so remote? Maybe it's pushing people away because it has that terrain.
It's limited resources and they don't want anything to come in there and take from it. Could be,
right.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that it's guarding its territory because it's guarding its resources. Yeah, mm-hmm. And it just doesn't
could be a little more feral because of that, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of makes sense, too, because like I said earlier, Southern California has all sorts of these legends, and a lot of them were closer to civilization in the mm-hmm. early 70s. There's one story in particular that I like to tell. It's a story out of Fontana, which is sort of a L.A. suburb. It's near where I live here. And they used to have a racetrack there. It was a drag strip.
Oh, yeah.
And at night, they would run cars back and forth and make a ton of noise. And spectators there would always say, you know, there's a creature on the hillside that would come down to the fence and shake the fence and get all mad because of all the sound going on. And eventually, they drove that creature out. They ended up referring to it as the Raceway Monster. But eventually, it just never showed up again. So the theory that at least I have is that if these things do exist and they're here in Southern California or were, you know, as we pushed our way east and north, you know, the city did, these creatures were just kind of pushed out. And one of these places they can escape to, of course, is a state park the size of Rhode Island. So all they have to do is figure out how to survive there, and they kind of have it made.
Absolutely. I'll tell you guys, fascinating movie, and I encourage everyone to go rent it or buy it right now. You can do either or. Either on Apple TV Plus, or you can do it on Amazon Prime. Name of the movie, Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness in the Borrego Triangle. And fellas, you knocked it out of the park. This is really a great movie, and I encourage you guys to go explore an area of the world you probably will never set foot in. I can't imagine you're going to go have a picnic in this place. I know a lot of investigators now. I'll tell you this much, guys. You guys have opened up an area of the world where you're probably going to have some investigators that are going to want to go out there. I just want you guys to give your message to potential investigators that might want to go out there. What do you say to them?
Safety. That's number one is safety. I don't want to get sued because I sent somebody out to the desert, but take water, take some food, let somebody know where you're going, reliable transportation, that sort of thing. Just be smart when you're out there. Yeah. And, you know, as far as the paranormal stuff is concerned, just keep digging because there's tons of it. There's so much we didn't even get to touch. So there's tons and tons of content out there.
Yeah. I'd say take everything but chances out there.
Okay.
It's cars will get stuck. If you go off the road, you might make it 50 feet and you might get stuck. We got stuck out
Ask
there.
Us how we know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Make sure that you either have someone who knows what they're doing and knows the area and is well equipped, or you just don't go as far as you want to, maybe. But the good thing about the place is you can camp just about anywhere out there. If you're smart about it, you can go places you won't really be bothered that much, unless you are, and then come tell us, you know.
If you see something, you have to tell us.
That's the other rule. Like, if anything happens, we're the number one call. Yeah,
that's right. So that you can get it on the show. On either show, really.
On.
By the way, do you guys want to plug your podcast real quick? I mean, Let's start with Derek. Derek, of course, Monsters Among Us.
Perfect. Yeah, you can find Monsters Among Us. It's a call-in show about monsters, UFOs, ghosts, anything weird and strange. We release every Thursday. We're going on 8 seasons as of this weekend. Or I'm sorry, 8 years as of this weekend, 16 seasons in the bag. So, come check us out.
There you go. David.
Blurry Photos is my flagship one, I guess you could say. I started that in 2012. And you can find it same places. You can find Derek's. The first 200 episodes of it, I had a co-host. We had more of a comedic take on things, and then he left, and since then I've put out more like deeply researched things, more narration driven, and I look at things with, you know, a scientific view or skeptical view on stuff to see how things hold up. And I release whenever I can get the research done, which is a while these days. I've got a lot of irons in the fire. But if you also like your paranormal with comedy, you can check out Hysteria 51, as you mentioned earlier. Me and Brent Hand host that and cover all these topics and do it, you know, with a silly take, I guess you could say. And then for a completely different cup of tea, you could try a trivia with Quiz Quiz Bang Bang, which is just questions and answers that we have if you like pub trivia and want to brush up on your knowledge skills. And as you said earlier, Tim, I've got a bunch of audiobooks. A lot of them are Bigfoot based because Tom Lyons, the author, I read a lot of his stories. He puts out a lot of stuff about Bigfoot and tales, reports, things like that. So Wow. That's a couple of the things I've got going on.
You're a busy man. You're a busy man. You know, 5-minute frights. I have to ask you about that too, David. Now, one of the things that's getting quite popular in podcasting, I'll go on a quick tangent before we leave people, 5-minute podcasts.
Mm.
You're ahead of the trend, my friend, because seriously, my uncle has released two 5-minute podcasts and they are on fire. And he has a friend, Gary, who is making a boatload of money on 5-minute podcasts.
Well, I wish I could say the same. Tom Lyons also writes those. Now we haven't done one. He is very busy himself, so we kind of trailed that one off. I might pick it up someday with my own writings if I could, you know, find an extra hour in the 27 hours that I try to squeeze into a day. But we've got about 24 episodes of that. He wrote them, I narrated them. If you like that, that'll give you a taste of Tom's writing and all this stuff. He puts out a lot of content. So yeah, I would suggest that. And hopefully one day, Tim, I can pick that back up and keep going with that one.
All right. Well, I tell you, it's the shorter podcast format is where it's at. So yeah, that's what I've been told is shorter is better now for some reason. I think it's the attention span of America, but that's where it's at. So there you go.
I'm in trouble.
I know. Yeah, I am.
Mine
am
was 125
too.
Minutes.
I think. Yeah, I think my last one was right about 2 hours. So
right. I put out 2 2-hour podcasts and I kicked myself because I've been told I'm being told by consultants no hour tops. And my listeners are going to kill me for it too, because I like the hour. Or they like longer than an hour too. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm being told.
Can't please shorter. Anyone, can we?
No, we can't. You can't win for trying. That's right, Derek. Another reminder here, folks. Again, go watch this movie, Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness in the Borrego Triangle. I want to thank both you guys, Derek and David. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tim. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah, our pleasure.
I want to thank my guests today, Derek Hayes and David Flora, for being on the program. Again, the movie was excellent, and I want to recommend you guys pick it up, at least rent it. If you don't buy it, rent it on Apple TV Plus and on Amazon Prime. The name of the movie is Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness in the Borrego Triangle, and give those guys some business. Definitely check out that movie. It's very, very intriguing as to what they find out there and how they go about it. That's the most intriguing thing overall, how they go about their business in this arid climate, in this hostile climate. And it's just intriguing what they find out there as well. So, and the stories out there are intriguing. You wouldn't think in such a hostile environment, in such a desolate climate, that they would have so much of a rich paranormal history, but there really is out there in the Borrego Triangle. So I found it fascinating. It really is fascinating the type of stuff that's coming out now that a lot of the bigger networks are starting to fold their paranormal programming, and now that independent producers are starting to come out with things on their own. So I really did enjoy this, and I'm glad that Derek and David have come forward and produced this documentary for you guys. So go ahead and check it out. And again, the link is in the description of this program. So I want to thank those guys for being on today. You know, I've gotten some emails in the last day or two of people saying, okay, Tim, I want your Kirk Cousins rant. Just let it go, man. Just give it to us. Well, no, it's too late. I mean, even today as I'm sitting here and watching TV and putting together the show today, there's another news story that came over the wire. It came from Pro Football Talk saying that Kirk Cousins, slightly before the legal tampering window started, talked to the trainer of the Atlanta Falcons, or it might have been just as the legal tampering window opened. He talked to the trainer to let him know exactly what was going on with his Achilles. As in, his Achilles may or may not be ready for the season. Well, there's also one other team. I think it was between the Bears and in San Francisco that just got nicked by the NFL for tampering before the tampering. If you can keep track of the tampering, essentially what happens here is San Francisco owes the Bears a pick now because they were tampering. I know this is paranormal stuff and we're talking football, but essentially here's what's happening. If you want to get my Irish up, which I think you guys are trying to do, I think you want to hear a good old-fashioned rant from an old guy. You just want to see if my top will blow here. Yeah, you know what? The Falcons owe the Vikings a draft pick. This isn't the first time you screwed us. You screwed us when it came to our Super Bowl. Yeah, I'm talking 98. I know it's been a while. It's been 26 years. You owe us again. You owe us a draft pick. Because you tampered with Kirk Cousins. We knew it. We knew it weeks ago when he was house shopping down there. But yeah, so you screwed us. Congratulations. You get the loser anyways. I'll just leave you with this quote, and it's simply this. Dan Patrick put it perfectly on his show on Wednesday. And this is exactly what Atlanta is getting. And this is all I have to say. And I'll put it just the way Dan put it. It's a direct quote. Dan explained why he thinks the Vikings may have went the right direction in not re-signing Kirk. And it's simply this. He says he's a B to B plus talent, A plus in money, and D minus in results when it comes to playing in big games and getting into the playoffs. He's won one playoff game. And that's absolutely true. Great in the regular season. Oh, you'll have a great time watching him. If he can hold on to the football. He's great for fleece in your front office. If you want to see your money go away, he'll never let go of any of his money to help your team. He's a great highway robbery guy. Roy Gardner II, as far as I'm concerned, he's robbing your train. He's getting away with the bag. But you'll never ever see him sacrifice for your team. He'll take off his shirt, he'll put on some chains, he'll look ridiculous, and then his wife will come by and she'll dress him with Kohl's cash. There you go. But as far as I'm concerned, the man's an idiot. And I've been saying it for a while now. I led the charge. He's no leader. And as far as I'm concerned, Atlanta didn't have any more talent than Minnesota. So don't get delusional and think that you guys are going to a Super Bowl. You're not. If you even sniff the playoffs, you'll be lucky. So you guys just threw a bunch of money out the window for nothing. You were probably better off staying in the draft at number 8 and getting yourself a decent quarterback. It is what it is. All right, there's your negativity. You got a little bit out of me. It's not what I said in the chat room. In the chat room, I think I scared people. I think they actually called a crisis counselor for me, and I think I ignored the call, by the way. It came from a strange number. I generally do that. All right, let's lighten it up before the end of the show here. I've seen most of my chipmunk buddies. I think all three of them are out now. Today, Wicked came out. I got a little bit of a video. I think I'm going to put it on the blog. I'm not going to put it on social media. So if you go to darknessradioshow.com, I'll put up the video of Wicked today. Wicked and I had lunch. The reason why it's so funny, he stared at me the entire time. He just sat there and he stared, kind of like, I don't know if I trust you yet, so I'm just going to watch you while I eat. So it's just 28 seconds of a chipmunk looking directly at me as he eats. It's kind of a cute video. I showed the chat room this afternoon. So I'll put that up at darknessradioshow.com in the blog section. And you guys can watch a chipmunk eat lunch. It's your sign that spring is still coming if it hasn't shown up in your area yet. It's supposed to get cold this weekend here in the Twin Cities, so we have a little bit of chillier weather as we celebrate St. Paddy's Day. By the way, happy St. Patrick's Day if you're Irish. If you are, you get a pinch or you get a kiss. I don't remember which one it is. I know one of them you get slapped for. I don't remember which one it is, though. I'm not that Irish. So there you go. So happy St. Paddy's Day if you're Irish. Have a great weekend this weekend, folks. Again, be a light in someone's darkness this weekend. Help somebody out if you can. otherwise, just enjoy your weekend. Have a great weekend. No can aside this weekend for myself. I'm just going to enjoy the weekend myself and enjoy the St. Paddy's Day festivities. So that's what I'm going to do. Again, be safe. If you're enjoying St. Paddy's Day, if you're out at any of the parades, or if you're enjoying it a little bit of the green beer, be sure to have a designated driver. We want you all to get home safe. So there you go. Got a great week of shows next week. Got a great True Crime Tuesday show in store. I know that much. Let's see. Who do we have on tap next week for Darkness Radio? For Darkness Radio next week. Oh, you know what? We have another Dennis on the program that's not named Bob. That's right. For our Thursday interview. We'll let you know a little bit about her coming up next week. So it's an exciting week next week here on Darkness Radio. I'll tease you with that. Thank you so much for being a continued listener of the show. You are valued, you are loved, and we appreciate the fact that you take all that time out of your busy schedule to be with us here on the best in paranormal programming. I want to thank Jessica Freeberg for sitting in this week. I want to thank Beer City Bruiser and Mally as well for continuing to be great friends of the program and continuing to be great co-hosts as well. And continued professionalism and just being all around great people. I know they've been going through some busy stuff in their lives and some hectic stuff in their lives as well. And as friends and family, I just want to tell all three of those people that I love them so much and appreciate them so much. And we've all been going through some tough stuff in our lives lately. So sometimes you just need to remind people and remind them publicly how much you love them. And I love all three of those people. So I want to thank them so much for being in my life, as well as thank you guys as well. So next week, True Crime Tuesday, Darkness Radio. Join us right here. Same time, same channel. See you next week for Darkness Radio.